here it is. I went out and I started my car at 2 o'clock, and it was 100 degrees in the shade. I love this weather. I love a heat dome. I don't know how much longer it's going to last. I have a bad feeling that it's going to be out of here in the next few days, but I'm loving it right now. It's the Panic Podcast. I'm your Bible study buddy, Mike, and we are in the book of Job today. We're looking at Job chapters 4, 5, 8, and 11 on the Panic Podcast. All right, I'm okay. I could not find my glasses. I got them. I don't want to tell you they were on my head because they weren't, but they were closer even than that. Hey, it's really good to have you. It's Tuesday. Your ears are not deceiving you. It is not Wednesday morning. It's Tuesday afternoon, but I got a pile of things to do tomorrow, so I wanted to make sure we got the podcast out today. And so here we are on this glorious, heat-filled, sun-filled summer day here in Southwest Virginia. I these are the days I live for. They're far too few in this cloudy part of the country. But boy, it has been so nice all week long, it's going to continue. I think we've got some rainy weather coming in for the weekend and cooler temperatures. Of course, that's all relative because it's been so hot. But I think we'll be in the we have a day or two where it's going to be in the upper 70s and low 80s, but it looks like the mid 80s next week. A little wetter than it is this week, but I managed to get my deck cleaned yesterday. It took me all day to do it because I had to do it when it was cooler in the morning and then cooler in the evening. And I worked in between, but I had to clean my deck. Yeah, it's so wet in this part of the country that you get this green mold everywhere. So I got the deck clean and started on the siding of the house, but it's just too hot. Try to get to that tomorrow. But we got a lot going on. So let's get started. Job chapter 6, verse 14, we have an interesting verse that goes like this. And this is Job says, "In trouble like this, I need loyal friends, whether I've forsaken God or not." That's a good verse. You know, when a friend or family member is suffering, I think it's natural for us to want to help them. The problem is most of us are not counselors. And so when we offer counsel or advice, all too often, we only add to the suffering person's problems. Like, we usually speak out of our own personal experiences, which is a natural thing to do, but our experiences are our experiences. Like, they're very often unique to us, not necessarily to the other person. And usually when we're trying to help other people, we often make nonsensical statements like this. "Well, God needed another angel in his heavenly choir." That's one of the stupidest things you can tell somebody who's lost a loved one. "Well, God needed another angel in his heavenly choir." That's a horrible thing to say. Horrible. Or we misapply Bible verses. Christians are awfully good at this. Like Romans 8:28, when something bad is happening to somebody, we'll say things, "Well, you know what the Bible says, in all things God works for good with those who love him." That verse has got nothing to do with what you're suffering. That's got nothing to do with that. Or this one. This one is frequently misapplied. Matthew 18:20, "Where two or three come together in my name, I'm there with them." That's got nothing to do with the fact that your church may be small or that a couple of you get together for prayer and Bible study. That's got to do with church discipline. Well, Job's three friends, they've come to help their friend. And they were significant men in the ancient Near East. They were wealthy, wise, influential, and they earnestly wanted to help their friend Job to cope with his tremendous losses. But they only made things worse. They spoke without understanding Job's situation at all. As a matter of fact, you know, it's interesting when you read what all the friends said. Like if you read all the three cycles of speeches, you'll discover that a lot of what they say is not bad theology at all. Now, some of it is, but most of it is pretty sound theology, but it was wrongly applied. Now, Job's friends, they traveled a great distance in order to comfort him. Their initial silence was out of respect and compassion, but also bewilderment. Job 2:13 says, "Then they sat there on the ground with Job for 7 days and nights without saying a word because they saw how much he was suffering." So I bet Job was almost unrecognizable by the time his friends got to him. I mean, not only was he in great physical distress, but also emotional and mental anguish. He didn't look like he used to look like. Well, Job spoke last time we were together, and he'd shown in his lament that he couldn't accept his fate with inner fortitude, you know. And he said some things that got the ire of his friends up, and they felt compelled to address some of the things that Job had said. These were three friends, and friendship is a favorite theme in both the Oriental and Hebrew wisdom literatures. And the ancient sages like to say that friends should reprove as well as sympathize. And that's what you have going on in the speeches of the three friends. They take Job to task for some of the things that he says, his statements about God or about them. So not only do they want to comfort Job, but they also want to set him straight in the way he's thinking. The major argument of the book of Job takes the form of a formal discourse by Job and his friends. So Job says things, and then each of the three friends say things that Job answers back and forth. These arguments are organized into cycles. There's three of them all together. Each of the friends speaks and is in turn answered by Job. As I said, there are three of these cycles, with the exception that in the third and final cycle, there's some incompleteness. And all of a sudden, in the last cycle of speeches, up pops another friend, like a fourth friend out of nowhere, and he's younger, and he gives Job his advice. Actually, Elihu is the youngest of the friends, the fourth one in that only shows up in the last few minutes of the of the book, and a lot of what he says is good. Well, the first cycle of speeches runs from chapter 4 to 14. Don't get excited. We're not going to look at all three cycles. The first friend to speak up was a man by the name of Eliphaz, and he was probably the oldest of the group and the most learned of the three. And Eliphaz goes so far as to accuse Job of wrongdoing. In other words, Job is suffering because of something that he did. Let's read Job 4, verses 1 to 9. "Job, will you be annoyed if I speak? I can't keep quiet any longer. You have taught many people and given strength to feeble hands. When someone stumbled, weak and tired, your words encouraged him to stand. Now it's your turn to be in trouble, and you're too stunned to face it. You worship God, and your life was blameless, and so you should have confidence and hope. Think back now. Name a single case where someone righteous met with disaster. I've seen people plow fields of evil and plant wickedness like seed, and now they harvest wickedness and evil. Like a storm, God destroys them in his anger. Ouch! Ouch! So Eliphaz begins by being gentle and kindly. He tactfully asks Job to listen to him. Eliphaz knows that anyone afflicted as Job must of necessity be under extreme emotional and physical pressure, so he asks for permission to speak. It's humorous that in the Hebrew, the phrase that is translated, "Will you be annoyed if I speak," can also be translated like this, "Would you be bored if I speak?" Well, given what Job had said, and you could always listen to last week's podcast, because we talked in depth about what Job said, Eliphaz thought it was absolutely necessary for somebody to speak up. So he did. Like Job's outburst just couldn't go unanswered. Job needed to understand. He should understand this, since he himself had advised many, many others. Like he said in verse 4, when someone stumbled weak and tired, your words encouraged him to stand. Like Job had given support and comfort in the past, but now that trouble had fallen on him, apparently, as far as Eliphaz thought, Job had forgotten his own advice. As far as Eliphaz could tell, while Job had helped others in trouble, now it was his turn to suffer, and instead of being able to cope, like take his own advice, here's Job impatient and dismayed. Verse 7, he says, Eliphaz says, think back now. Name a single case where someone righteous met with disaster. To Eliphaz, his theology is pretty simple. When a person trusts in God and lives righteously, then that person lives a good life blessed by God. In trying to comfort and advise Job, Eliphaz points to what he thinks is a self-evident truth. The expected response to that, to verse 7, think back now, name a single case where someone righteous met with disaster. The expected response is that the righteous are never driven to destruction by trouble. On the contrary, as far as Eliphaz is concerned, destruction is the fate of the wicked. That's what he says in verse 8. I've seen people plow fields of evil and plant wickedness like seed, then they harvest wickedness and evil. So what Eliphaz is saying here is that Job, now in his suffering, he's reaping what he sowed, at least according to Eliphaz. Basically, Eliphaz is suggesting that Job is being disciplined for something he had done, disciplined in the way he had lived. Look at verse 18 to 21. Do you think he will trust, 18, God does not trust his heavenly servants. He finds fault even with his angels. Do you think he'll trust a creature of clay? A thing of dust that can be crushed like a moth? We may be alive in the morning, but die unnoticed before evening comes. All that we have is taken away. We die, still lacking wisdom. So, Eliphaz's theology. I mean, it sounds good and is accurate up to a point. Like, part of what Eliphaz is trying to get across to Job is that an afflicted person can be a happy person. Like, even if you're suffering, you can be happy. You got to have the right perspective, though. And it's true that God wounds people in order to discipline them. We learn that in the New Testament. It's also accurate to say that God does deliver the righteous. However, this wise friend's theology breaks down when we consider the first two chapters of the book of Job. All through Eliphaz's argument, The implication is that Job was not righteous and that all of his losses were what he deserved. Now, of course, we know none of that's true because God had declared Job to be righteous, and God can't be wrong. Therefore, Eliphaz must be wrong. A lot of what Eliphaz says is good theology. It's just wrongly applied. Now, that gets us to Job chapter 8. And the next friend is Bildad, a fellow by the name of Bildad. And his theology is as simple as that of Eliphaz, who believed that God is just and that a person got from God what he deserved. Bildad believed that fate showed a reasonable God. Now, unlike Eliphaz, Bildad's theology was grounded in reason rather than revelation. So we would almost call Bildad like a traditionalist. As he speaks to Job, we can sense his, his bubbling anger at what he considers to be Job's irreverence. So let's have a look at Job chapter 8. And this is Bildad. Are you finally through with your windy speech? Well, Bildad is responding to things that Job had just said. So he says, are you finally through with your windy speech? God never twists justice. He never fails to do what is right. He says, your children must have sinned against God. And so he punished them as they deserved. Lord have mercy. That's a terrible thing to say to a man who's just lost his whole family. Your children must have sinned. How does he know? How does he know anything about the heart of these children? Your children must have sinned against God, and so he punished them as they deserved. This is Bildad's theology. So Job's friend suggested that if Job would become pure and upright, God would restore him. Look at verse 5. But turn now and plead with the Almighty God. If you're so honest and pure, and then God will come and help you and will restore your household as your reward. All the wealth you lost will be nothing compared with what God will give you then. Kind of interesting that that's exactly what happens to Job at the end of the book, but not for the reason that what the Bildad says. He encourages Job to look at the past. He says, look for a moment at ancient wisdom. Consider the truths our ancestors had learned. That's not bad advice. That's good to do. It's good to do those sorts of things. Appealing to the wisdom of the past is a good thing. There's a lot that you can learn from what others have experienced. Like Bildad, if you read the rest of chapter 8, we're not going to take the time because we're running out of it. But Bildad uses a bunch of metaphors to get his theology across to Job, including things like papyrus, a spider's web, and a plant. Like as papyrus reads, die without moisture, so the impious perish without God. What they trust will not last because they rely on things as fragile as a spider's web. In verses 16 to 19, Bildad uses another figure to illustrate sudden destruction. A plant is quickly destroyed, leaving no trace of it. Boy, that's absolutely true. I have a bunch of clover and weeds in my yard, so I sprayed it. And in less than 24 hours, you'd never know there was clover there or weeds at all. They turn brown. And Lord willing, the grass is going to fill in those spots. But that's what happened. A plant is quickly destroyed and it leaves no trace of itself. You know, while the plant is alive, its branches fill the garden and its roots spread everywhere among the stones. But when it's destroyed, it's like the plant was never there. What's worse, where that great plant once was, other plants just come in and take over. Bildad the old-fashioned theologian applies these lessons from nature to the relationship that exists between God and man. Job 8, verse 20. But God will never abandon the faithful or give help to evil people. Well, that's good theology. That's true. But on the other hand, God will not help evildoers. You know, to Bildad, Job's suffering proves that something is wrong with Job. But he believes that God will restore him. Look at verse 21. He will let you laugh and shout again. Well, Bildad hasn't explicitly accused Job of wickedness yet, but his warning in verse 22 has that implication. If Job persists in his wickedness, he will be completely destroyed. Now, as you read what Bildad says in all the cycles, in all three cycles of speeches, it's hard to argue against a lot of what he said. Bildad's theology is generally sound, and we would do well to take notice of it. But once again, it just doesn't apply to Job. That gets us to the third friend, Job chapter 11. His name is Zophar, and Zophar is the dogmatist. And he feels that he must defend the justice of God, just as the other two friends have done. But Job's response to Bildad in chapters 9 and 10, he makes some statements that Zophar must respond to. Here's what Job says. Job 9, verse 15, he says, though I'm innocent, all I can do is beg God for mercy from God, my judge. And then verse 18, he says, God won't let me catch my breath. He's filled my life with bitterness. This is a man in pain talking. Verse 34, Job chapter 9, verse 34. He screams out to God, stop punishing me, God. Keep your terrors away. And in Job chapter 10, 16, Job says something that's, I mean, it's a little harsh. He says, if I have any success at all, God hunts me down like a lion to hurt me, even though he works miracles. Well, Job, he can't sit quiet after hearing things like that. He has to respond. And in doing so, Zophar comes across as being very severe. Like Bildad, Zophar lacks compassion. And he comes across as being really judgmental. He thought Job, who was suffering to the point of despair, was in fact getting much less than he deserved. Look at verse, let's start reading some of verse, verse 11, chapter 11, beginning to read at verse 1. Will no one answer all this nonsense? That's what Zophar says. Does talking so much put you in the right? Job, do you think we can't answer you? That your mocking words will leave us speechless? You claim that what you say is true. You claim you are pure in the sight of God. Oh, how I wish God would answer you. He would tell you there are many sides to wisdom. There are things too deep for human knowledge. Well, that's true, actually. He would, can you, listen to this, can you discover the limits and bounds of the greatness and power of God? You know, a lot of what Zophar says is correct. And a lot of it sounds like what God himself says at the end of the book. Verse 8, the sky is no limit for God, but it lies beyond your reach. God knows the world of the dead, but you don't know it. God's greatness is broader than the earth, wider than the sea. If God arrests you and brings you to trial, who is there to stop him? God knows which people are worthless. He sees all their evil deeds. Stupid people will start being wise when wild donkeys are born tame. Verse 13, put your heart right, Job. Reach out to God. Put away evil and wrong from your home. Then face the world again, firm and courageous. Then all your troubles will fade from memory, like floods that are past and remembered no more. Your life will be brighter than the sunshine at noon, and life's darkest hours will shine like the dawn. You will live secure and full of hope. God will protect you and give you rest. You won't be afraid of your enemies. Many people will ask you for help, but the wicked will look around in their despair and find that there is no way to escape. Their one hope is that death will come. You know, Zophar considered Job's words pure mockery, because in his mind, Job was claiming flawless doctrine and sinless perfection. Verse 4, you claim what you say is true. You claim you are pure in the sight of God. Well, Zophar is not right there. Job has steadfastly maintained his innocence compared to the wicked, but he never claimed to be perfect or pure. Actually, God claimed he was perfect. Job complained bitterly of the treatment God appeared to be giving him, but he has never mocked God or even ridiculed any of his friends. He accused them of being shallow and callous, which they were, but he never said anything to them that would be considered disrespectful. You know, the third friend, Zophar, I mean, he's wrong on so much, but he does make some very eloquent statements about God's infinitude, his justice, omniscience. Zophar's estimate of God's greatness is intended to suggest the enormity of God, of Job's sin, whatever that sin may be. In his mind, Job must be guilty of some tremendous sin because of the greatness of his suffering, which he took to be God's way of exposing some secret sin. That Job wouldn't admit it was evidence of his pride and of his hardness of heart. Therefore, Job needed to be humbled. Zophar touches on the omnipotence and the omniscience of God, who sees through Job as if he were made of glass. Zophar's words, I would say, were designed to humble Job, but in the end, Zophar labeled Job as a witless, empty-headed man, with as much of a chance to become wise as a wild donkey has to be born tame. As far as Zophar is concerned, Job's only hope was to repent. Now, this is good advice for anybody who's lived a life full of sinful indulgence, but Job hadn't. It was the height of arrogance for Zophar to assume that he knew why Job was suffering. He'd reduced this solution of this very complex human problem to a simplistic formula. That is, every pain has sin behind it. That's not true. Job's friend here erroneously suggested that if a person repents and gets right with God, then all of his troubles would be over. That's not at all true. A lot of righteous people suffer. It's a very common error, by the way, made by many well-meaning Christians who fail to distinguish between forensic forgiveness that cancels the guilt of sin and the immediate consequence of a sinful life that often brings trouble and distress. But once again, we know what Zophar couldn't possibly know, that Job's troubles were not the result of a profligate life. Job's 100% wrong. Zophar was 100% wrong. Job's troubles did not come as a penalty from God. So these friends, these three guys, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, came with good intentions to comfort their friend in the midst of his suffering. They came with very sound theology for the most part. Their doctrine was true. Their theology was sound. But their good intentions, their sound theology and good doctrines, only made everything worse for Job. They spewed pious platitudes that may have sounded good and may in fact have been very good, but lacked any context. May we never be guilty of that. Let's never be so arrogant as to think we know everything and the suffering person knows nothing. Let's never assume that somebody is getting what they deserve because hard times have fallen on them. Let's never be so callous as to say things like, well, I knew it all along. I knew he was too good to be true. I had a feeling. Please don't ever be like that. Don't be like Job's friends. Be wise like Job's friends. They had a lot of wisdom. Job's friends, to me, they had enviable wisdom. But man, they were cold, cold and harsh. Let's not be like that. All right, gang, 31 minutes past the hour. Go on out and make the most of what's left of your day. I don't know when you're listening to this. It's a Tuesday afternoon as I'm recording it and uploading it. Have a great rest of the day today. Have a great day tomorrow. For those of you in my church, no Bible study tomorrow. We are off until the first Wednesday in August. All right. But have a great rest of the day and a great rest of the week. Lord willing, we'll be back here on Friday with another study in Revelation. God bless you. Thank you for listening to the Panic Podcast.